You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. This is Alex Knight, and I am joined by Michael Norton. Episode 115, An Apple Watch or iPhone Left Behind. This week on the podcast, are the current MacBook Pros a step backwards in design? Two generations of Apple's butterfly keyboard, and they still haven't gotten it right. Apple Watch apps and Watch OS need a major redesign for version 5.0. And lastly, iOS feature succession and why older devices start to feel slow. Is Apple planning obsolescence, or is it cutting ties with older hardware for the greater good? So stay tuned for that discussion and more. That's coming up next on The Impromptu. The MacBook Pro, it's obviously a product much beloved by Apple and by many, but it's not something that has particularly excited people, I think, in the last couple of years. And I know that there are a lot of longtime fans of the MacBook Pro that think that there are various things about it that are a step backwards in terms of design.
Mm-hmm.
And Marco Arment wrote a great article that goes really sort of itemizes all the things, all the problems, and sort of ends with the things Apple could be doing to fix it. So why don't you start us off, Michael? What is the problem with the MacBook Pro as of 2017?
Well, there's no one problem. There's kind of a bunch of problems that add up to a big problem. First off, the butterfly switches on the keyboard are terrible. They need to die in a fire of molten aluminum. They came out with them for the MacBook. And in the case of the MacBook, it was a trade-off. They were saying, okay, let's try and make the thinnest laptop we possibly can. And so the butterfly switches were kind of born out of that desire to try and create an ultra-thin laptop. So they came up with these switches that took up far less vertical height. And when they did that, people were kind of upset because you would press down on those keys and not feel anything. It was essentially like typing on an iPad. No feedback at all, just like barely any recognition. And people used to typing on a regular keyboard, they would end up hurting their fingers because they were trying to hit the keys with the same level of pressure.
Almost makes me wonder why they even bothered with this design, because like you're saying, there's almost no tactile feedback.
Yeah, and I mean, they've gone through three iterations of these keys, as Arment points out. Three tries at this. And every time, it's still the same problems, the same issues with travel, the same issues with reliability and repairability. There was a blog post a few months ago. Somebody got a speck of dust trapped inside one of the switches, and it kept it from typing. You would try hitting that key, and it would not work. He takes it into the Apple Store. They're like, oh, I guess it's a speck of dust. And he basically had to have the entire top case replaced.
I hope he had warranty on that.
Oh, he did.
That's an expensive thing to do.
Yeah, he did, but
right.
It was replaced with no guarantee it wouldn't happen again. So, I mean, this is clearly a flawed design if a speck of dust can get in there and ruin it.
Well, it would have had to be more than that.
No, it really wasn't. His key just stopped working all of a sudden. That's it. Like, with these switches, apparently it can just screw up randomly without warning.
Well, I guess that's what happens when they design these things in a, you know, hermetically sealed box. I mean,
yes.
You know, in a dust-free environment.
No,
but no, I don't know.
No dust shall live in the vault of Johnny Ive.
Right. You know, you would think that, I mean, they're smart people. You would think that they would somehow anticipate stuff getting in there.
Well,
that would prevent it working.
That's the thing.
They must have thought about that. Must have come up in a design meeting.
That's the thing, though. Like the original scissor keys on every other product,
mm-hmm.
including the current Magic Keyboard. And by the way, he recommends replacing the MacBook Pro switches with the switches on the Magic Keyboard, which, yes, please, because the Magic Keyboard is awesome. Those keys are thinner than they've been, but still with enough travel to be comfortable. So, I mean, it would be a really good compromise if they just put those switches in.
Yeah.
Because they'd still be thinner than previous ones, but it still is a really good typing experience.
We've gone through, what, 3 generations of this butterfly design?
Yeah.
And it's still, gotten marginally better, but really...
Yeah, basically.
Not nearly far enough.
No. Like, they've had...
Fourth time's the charm, I guess, right? We'll see. Next year.
I doubt it. I mean, if you haven't gotten it right after 3 tries, give up. Like, it's not going to happen. Especially with issues like... Oh, it fails if a speck of dust gets into it. Like, that's the one thing I just can't get over. Like, if that happens, you need to go back to the drawing board because you fucked up.
I don't disagree. There's other stuff that is problematic with the MacBook Pro. So what else is Marco talking about here?
So the other big thing is get rid of the touch bar. And I can't say I disagree. The touch bar...
It really hasn't had time to bake, though, has it? I mean, don't you think it's a little premature?
To be honest, it just doesn't really offer that much. It's replacing keys that were perfectly fine, and it's adding a supposedly dynamic interface. But the problem is, 99% of the time, your hands are near the trackpad. You have to stoop over the keyboard to interact with the touch bar. And you have to angle your head to look at the screen.
It doesn't have a good viewing angle?
Well, I would say not, because the entire bottom case is flush. It's lying flat on the table. So you kind of have to look over the keyboard to see it. So you're not looking straight ahead at the screen. Like, basically, you have to break rules about good computer posture just to be able to use the thing. And I find that highly ironic because the reason Apple has historically never wanted to do a touchscreen on their laptops is because they felt that craning your arms to the screen would be uncomfortable. So, I mean, I don't really see how this is that much better, for starters. And then, it doesn't really offer that much utility, to be honest. You could already scrub through timelines on Premiere and Final Cut by using the trackpad. So, I'm not sure how much time it actually saves to do it on the touch bar. And same thing for media controls. Like, you had media keys. You didn't really need the controls that are on the touch bar. It all just feels like something new for the sake of something new. It's not really changing the game in terms of interaction design for desktop computing.
I mean, the Touch ID part is the best part of that.
Yeah, and
for sure. But of course, now we're moving to Face ID.
Yeah, and that's what he points out. He basically says, Touch ID, leave it in. Leave in the secure enclave. Have that security there. And this is something that I think Apple is going to continue doing, because this is another big story I wanted to talk about. The iMac Pro, it turns out, has an A10 chip in it.
I saw that, and that was a big surprise to me. And I think a lot of people were not expecting that to happen.
And not only that, this A10 chip controls the iMac Pro. It tells the Intel chip when to turn on. The entire secure boot sequence of the iMac Pro all of the hardware controls, that is all handled by an A-series chip.
That's interesting because I remember years, this is probably not the case now, but I remember towards the end of the original Mac Pros, or I should say not the original, but the last generation pre-trash can, the cheese grater era, mm-hmm. which the last year those came out was 2012. I remember for years in the Mac Pro, Intel was the company that designed the logic board for Apple. I guess that must not be the case now, because why would Intel make a board that worked with Apple's chips that compete with Intel?
Oh, yeah, no.
They must have stopped that a while ago.
Oh, yeah. Like, the trash can and all the MacBooks and the iMac, they've all been custom logic board designs for a while now. I think the cheese grater.
Foxconn is making that stuff now.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, or TSMC, whoever, Hanhai. There's a bunch of companies that could probably do it over there.
So this is the beginning, which we've touched on previous episodes. I'm sure listeners probably remember us talking about stuff like this. The eventual move to a completely ARM-based or Apple design-based CPU lineup for their Macs, which is obviously starting to happen.
Yeah,
I mean, this. I'm sure Apple is probably going to go further than they are with this new iMac. I mean, they're not going to just stop there. I very much doubt that.
This is God,
pretty
no.
much a hint, like, hint, wink.
This is absolutely a wink.
Right.
Like, you've got an A-series chip, a recent A-series chip, starting to slowly take over core system functionality on a Mac.
Apple's just sitting there, like, rubbing their hands and smiling right now. You wait.
Yeah, and amusingly enough, the chip is actually referred to as Bridge, and it runs...
an appropriate name.
And it runs Bridge OS. So, yeah, there's a little bit tongue-in-cheek there. And I think clearly they're trying to telegraph that the A-series chips are a bridge to the future of computing.
You don't say.
Yeah. It's funny how that's happening.
Yeah.
It's almost like the iPad Pro was some sort of hint.
Yeah.
When they talked about desktop performance and so on. Yeah, get the new Mac iPad Pro. Right. It's as powerful as a desktop. You don't say. So yeah, like the MacBook Pro started this. So like to make Touch ID work, they added a bridge chip, which is probably like an A8 or an A9 secretly, or at least like some variant thereof. And it handles Apple Pay and Touch ID, and it also controls the camera and microphone.
Yeah.
So on the MacBook Pro, the new one, thanks to the bridge chip, it's basically impossible for a hacker to gain access to your webcam because macOS does not actually control it. And even if they could get the webcam to turn on, they would not be able to disable the LED. So you would know if it was activated because basically the Intel part of the system doesn't have access to it. It basically... relays a signal to the bridge chip that says, hey, turn on the webcam. And then that is entirely controlled by the bridge chip. And that obviously goes further with the iMac Pro. Now the entire boot sequence is run by the bridge chip. So the computer could technically be in a state of always on because it's an A-series chip. So, I mean, the iMac Pro could basically always be on. And then... when you hit the power button, it just says, hey, Intel, wake up.
Yeah.
Like a lock button, kind of. It also means that because it's an A-series chip, it has the dedicated Hey Siri always listening stuff. So they actually found a modal in the code that showed setting up Hey Siri. So the iMac Pro will actually be the first Mac that has Hey Siri functionality. So instead of pressing a button or a keyboard shortcut, you're now going to be able to talk to your Mac. So I would assume that trend will continue because obviously they want Hey Siri functionality in all Macs. So it's more than possible that the next MacBook Pro will continue this. And even encourages that. He basically says, keep the bridge chip, keep Touch ID, or move to Face ID if that's possible. I would assume it's not at this juncture. Basically, all the true depth cameras that they can make are going into the iPhone X. So I wouldn't expect true depth or Face ID to make it into anything until next year at the earliest. Although next year, they're going to have two or three new iPhones that use Face ID. So they're going to have to drastically ramp up production on them. Though, now that they've solved the yield issues, it should be easier. And the cost will be driven down as well, because they'll have been manufacturing them for over a year.
Right.
So, I mean, it's possible that we see Face ID on something else next year, but I would bet on 2019 for the first wave of new products. Though, supposedly, the new iPad next year is going to have Face ID. So that'll be interesting to see if that actually pans out or not.
You know, you mentioned the charger earlier before we started recording, this USB-C-based charger. Now, I haven't had a new MacBook Pro in quite a few years, and I wasn't aware that they got rid of the cable management prongs.
Yes.
Which most people, if you've had a MacBook, an older one at least, you know what I'm talking about. Those two little retractable prongs that allow you to wrap the power cable around, which is a really nice feature, the cable management feature. I never had a problem with it, so I don't understand why they would take that away. And we don't have to spend this much time on it, but it is a minor thing, but it is a nice thing. And I'm not entirely sure why they took that away. But anyways, Marco was saying they should add that back. And I agree.
Like, he also said they should add back the LED that tells you it's charging, which, duh, that is kind of important. You're not always looking at the screen to see if it's charging or not. So having that visual aid...
Well, is there no LED on the side of the laptop, though, that tells you it's not...
No, they used all of that stuff is gone now.
Yeah, they used to have like a 5-segment LED or something crazy like that on the old ones.
Yeah, that was like on the old MacBook Pro. Like on...
My 2010 model had
on
that.
The Retina one, like the more recent Retina ones, it went like unibody aluminum and then they got rid of it because the bottom case is literally just this very refined aluminum enclosure. So that's gone.
Yeah,
so
drilling tiny little holes for LEDs, probably not worthwhile.
They didn't drill. It was actually a laser that sort of etched the holes.
Oh, was it?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
It was super clever.
Tiny holes anyways. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
But anyways, I guess it would have compromised the unibody structural integrity to do that or something. Or they didn't have room. But anyways, so the more recent ones, the only visual indicator as to whether the MacBook was charging or not was the LED on the MagSafe cable. Same thing for the MacBook Air. So now with these new MacBooks with USB-C, it's just a normal USB-C cable with the white Apple plastic. Like, there's no way to know if it's actually charging the MacBook or not without waking it up and looking at the menu bar.
I also think that those chargers should have dual ports on them, so you could say quick charge not only your MacBook Pro but other devices like an iOS device, because those chargers work really nicely on an iPhone 8 where you can get, I think, 30 minutes of charge time will get you 50% battery life, which is really fast.
Well, and then the other problem is these chargers are still way too expensive. Like, to get...
It's like $60, I think.
Guess again, to get the appropriate combo to fast charge an iPhone 8 or iPhone 10, you have to get minimum the 23-watt USB-C power adapter.
I think it's $59.99 or
something. And... a USB-C to Lightning cable.
Oh, the cable. Yeah, so, why don't they give you the cable?
So altogether, you basically spend $80.
I'm sorry, like a $60 charger with iPhone. No USB-C cable. That's stingy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That is ridiculous.
So yeah, the price on these accessories absolutely has to come down. I mean, it's not entirely Apple's fault. I mean, they are charging a premium for these things, but at the same time, USB-C does cost more to manufacture currently. So they are passing those costs on to the consumer.
How much is an Apple-made USB-C to Lightning cable?
So a 1 meter USB-C to Lightning cable is 39 Canadian.
So they probably have at least a 35% markup, I would guess.
Probably. Minimum.
Yeah. If their cost for a cable is like, say, $3 or $5, it might be more like $3 at the volumes that they have, right?
Yeah. I mean, sure, the unit price probably works out to something like that. But
come on. $3 cable, they can't include that with a $60 product? That's ridiculous. I'm sorry, I just think that's just bullshit.
Well, the thing is, those adapters are meant to be used with the MacBooks or the MacBook Pro. They weren't necessarily intended specifically for an iPhone.
Yeah, I know, but then they advertise that the iPhone 8 has this quick charging feature, but you can only do it with that 20-something watt charger.
Well, you can do it with any USB-C that has power delivery and that much
of course,
wattage.
I can go on Amazon and find one.
Yeah, of course. It's just like...
What does that USB, what does that PD stand for?
Power delivery.
Okay.
Yeah. It's basically the official spec for what Android manufacturers
I looked on Amazon, actually.
Quick charge.
I looked on Amazon, but it's a little unclear because a lot of products don't have the PD. I looked for that in the description, so I don't know if they're really going to work or not.
Yeah. The thing is, power delivery is fairly new. Like I said, it's the official spec for what Android manufacturers were calling Quick Charge. So for a while, there have been various versions of Quick Charge. The latest one is Quick Charge 3.0. So power delivery is actually an official USB standard for quick charging devices. The Nintendo Switch supports power delivery. The new MacBooks all support power delivery.
And the Xbox, too, I think, is what, USB-C now, isn't it?
No.
No? Okay. I thought it was.
No, Microsoft hasn't done any USB-C stuff yet.
Yeah.
Even the new Surface Book doesn't have a single USB-C port. They've kind of shunned it for some reason.
Do you have a recommended USB-C charger if someone wanted to get one off of Amazon? Have you encountered any that you can...
You can't get it in Canada, but there is a really good 30-watt USB-C charger made by Anker that you can get on Amazon in the States.
It's interesting because Amazon Canada has other Anker products, but not that one, huh?
Yeah. Some of their products make it to Canada, and then some, they just launch in the States, and then it takes like a few months
for it to be sold.
The cheapest
one
here.
I've seen on Amazon is about $20, which is pretty inexpensive in comparison to Apple's and other stuff.
Yeah. Those I'm not sure about. Like, unless it explicitly says power delivery, and even then, I'm not 100% sure. And you really have to be careful with USB-C because if it isn't to spec, it can actually fry your device.
Definitely be safer, albeit more costly, to buy an Apple MacBook charger to charge your iPhone 8.
Yeah.
iPhone 10.
If you buy Apple, you at least know that you're getting the right thing.
See, that's another thing. Like, I'd rather charge my phone fast than have quote unquote wireless charging. That charges, like, now, I believe is it iOS 11.2 that they're upping the wattage, supported wattage, so I think it goes up to
7.5 watts.
Yeah, but when you compare that to the quick charge, 23 watts or whatever that MacBook charger is.
Of course, but the thing is, you're only going to need fast charging if your phone is, like, nearly depleted, right? But if you have wireless charging and you kind of keep your phone on the pad all day, it's not going to matter. Like, it's constantly just charging, and you pick it
is
up.
We've gotten so lazy as a society, though, that we've gotten so lazy as a society that we can't just stick a lightning cable in that thing to charge it? Really? Are people losing their lightning cables all the time?
No.
Like, I don't get it. I don't get it.
It saves enough time that it's a convenience.
Yeah, I guess.
I've been using wireless charging at work and at home. Like, it's honestly kind of nice to just get home and just drop my phone on a thing and it's charging. Like, I don't have to fiddle with the cable. I just put it down on a surface and it's charging. I don't have to think about it. And same thing for work. I got one that's also a stand, so it actually positions my phone at the perfect angle to activate Face ID. So I just have it next to my keyboard and I can literally glance at my phone and it unlocks.
Nice.
While it's on the thing charging.
Magic.
Yeah. Like it works really well.
IKEA started selling these wireless chargers. Oh, yeah, I don't know how good it is, but it's like $11.
Yeah, they've had theirs for a while.
It's kind of nice that you can actually, like, it's designed to sit in a desk, like flush with the surface. So if you drill a hole for it, you can just put it flush right on the desk.
Yeah, they have the one you can drill into a desk. They've also got a lamp that's got it built in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they
I think like they have one meant to be like on your nightstand or something.
Yeah, they have a table lamp and they have a floor lamp with it. There's also, I think, a nightstand or a coffee table that has it built in as well. Yeah, they first started doing wireless charging a while ago, like I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, when she kind of took off and became the wireless charging standard. IKEA kind of got on the bandwagon and started integrating it into some of their furniture.
I think, does that wrap it up about the MacBook Pro? Pretty much, I think.
I think so. I mean, it's pretty clear Apple has some work to do. They need to be more proactive about the hardware that they're putting into it. These Intel integrated GPUs just aren't cutting it, especially for a professional product.
Yeah.
People who are working with video and other things, like, they need...
The SD card reader.
An SD card reader would be nice, but they need Radeon or NVIDIA, preferably NVIDIA graphics. They cannot work with Intel GPUs. They're just not powerful enough. And the software that they use isn't optimized for them. So Apple really needs to put AMD graphic chips. Like, if they can't use NVIDIA, that's fine. But they need to put Radeon Vega GPUs into all MacBook Pros.
I agree.
Not just the high-end 15-inch ones, the 13-inch ones as well, because people don't necessarily want a giant MacBook Pro. Sometimes they need something more portable, but they still need the power. And the current lineup, none of the 13-inch ones, even if you fully spec it all the way out to maximum, no GPU at all, just the Intel stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. You know, we should throw this question at the at our listeners, because I'd like to know, both of us would like to know how you feel about this. Are you still running an older 2015 MacBook Pro, or even older? What do you think about what's been holding you back from upgrading? Do you find this butterfly keyboard annoying? Let us know. Hit us up on Twitter and Facebook. We're at The Impromptu. Or, of course, you can also send us an email, which is always available. It's theimpromptu@hologramradio.org. And that email will go to Michael or myself.
Yeah. And I'd also be interested to know if anyone has deliberately bought a refurb 2015 MacBook Pro instead of getting the new one. I know a lot of people have done that.
Not just because of the cost savings, but because they preferred the older,
version. I've noticed that quite frequently the 2015 MacBook Pro becomes available for a short time, refurb, and it disappears in like 5 seconds. So
it's a great laptop.
It is. It is. And it has none of the disadvantages of the current one.
Yeah.
It's got the great keyboard.
Does it still have a dedicated GPU? On that one, it doesn't have the Intel on the 15-inch.
It depends which one you get.
If you get a max spec 15-inch, does it not have an AMD GPU in there?
Yeah, it's got a Radeon something or other.
Right.
But yeah.
So people would still even rather have a two-year-old AMD GPU than a modern Intel graphics GPU.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't surprise me.
No.
Because it would probably be better in many ways.
Plus, like, nobody wants to go through the USB-C dongle hell. Like, they just want a laptop that has HDMI, has an SD card slot.
External GPUs don't work on new MacBook Pros with USB-C?
Oh, they do, but that's additional cost.
Right.
Like, you have to buy an enclosure. Yeah. You have to buy the GPU itself.
What's the big deal, right? You're on an airplane. You're riding in economy.
You're editing a movie. You just crank out the giant metal enclosure.
If it's in the overhead compartment, who cares if you got a giant box?
You buy the other seat next to you.
Just buy the other seat.
You just slam it down on the seat.
No big deal.
And the fan's going and people are concerned because they think, like, something's happening
Where's all this heat coming from?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a good scene. I mean, you can use external GPUs with the new ones because of Thunderbolt 3, but it's not going to work for everyone, and it's not always going to be the ideal solution.
Yeah.
If you're on the go.
And speaking of not ideal solutions, we've talked about the Apple Watch, the Series 3 Watch, before in the last couple weeks. If you've listened to the last couple episodes, you'll know that I purchased an Apple Watch Series 3. It is my first Apple Watch. Overall, I really like it. If you want to know more of my thoughts, you should read my review, which is at zerodistraction.com. But for now, there are some things that do bother me, and I really do think it's really dragging down the experience, I have to say, because the hardware itself is awesome. I love that it's waterproof. I love how fast the CPU is. But the quality and the varying degrees of quality of third-party apps is all over the map. And it really drags the experience of the product down. I don't have the LTE version, but now that I've switched carriers and I have a really good cellular connection, I figured things would be more reliable. But like one example here, I'll pick on Facebook Messenger. Facebook Messenger half the time will not load the messages. It's got one job to load messages, and it can't even do that. Now, that isn't the watch's fault. It's obviously Facebook's fault. It sucks because I don't want to have to pull my phone out of the pocket. That's the whole reason I bought the goddamn watch in the first place. And it's not just Facebook. There are other apps that have similar performance issues. And I know it's not the Series 3's fault. It's not the hardware's fault. It is more than capable. Apple's own apps work fine.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Now, my understanding is that apps like Facebook are native apps, so I don't know why they're entire pieces of junk on the watch. But this leads me to the other thing that came out recently in the last week, that Apple, as of, I think, is it May, Michael, 2018, that Apple will no longer accept non-native watchOS apps, which is a great step forward.
And they will be culling them.
I don't know if they're getting rid of the other ones, but non-native apps.
Yeah, I think they'll be removed, which is going to be tricky because if you have an app that you haven't updated in a while that has a watch app, like a legacy watch app, I'm not sure what they're going to do. I think maybe it'll refuse to install it on the watch. And if it's on the watch, it'll get removed. Because otherwise, a ton of apps will just get taken off of the App Store just because they haven't updated their watch apps. Like, they might have updated the rest of the app frequently, and then the watch app is lacking.
It almost makes me think that now the reason why I didn't get the LTE watch is because my carrier currently doesn't support it. They're not going to support it until 2018. So I figured, what the hell? If it's not going to be supported until next year, why don't I just wait a year and then get the LTV, the second generation LTE watch that comes out next October, right? Which I think is a perfectly acceptable plan. But it started making me think today that maybe I should have gotten the LTE model. Let's say my carrier did support it. Would it be more reliable if it didn't rely on the iPhone's connection? See, I don't even know because it can't be just the iPhone's connection, because if other apps can pull data and sync properly, why is Facebook having such a problem, right? So in that case, LTE might not even solve the problem. I don't know. This is all hypotheticals.
Yeah.
I don't have an LTE watch to compare, right?
Yeah.
But it is annoying.
Yeah. I think part of it could be because Apple has private APIs that they use. Another part of it could be that the API that Apple does provide to developers relies too heavily on the Bluetooth connection. Although it's kind of weird because...
Yeah, but you know what? Even when my...
Series 3, it's got a W2 chip.
Yeah.
That's Bluetooth 5. That should be really fast.
Yeah, and I can tell you it makes no difference if I'm on cellular or Wi-Fi. I've got a fast 802.11ac wireless network in my home.
Mm.
My watch could be right next to my iPhone, both connected to the same network, and Facebook Messenger still doesn't load messages.
Yeah.
And there are other apps that have similar problems. Like it's sporadic. Like sometimes it'll work when I first open the app. Other times it won't work. And it'll sit there and all I see is a spinning wheel of death or whatever you call that, a wheel. It's not a beach ball, but it's something like that. It's like trying to do something. I don't know what the hell it's doing. Can somebody please, like, if you're listening to this right now, if you're a software developer, if you know any more about this, we'd really like to hear, because I want to know just what the hell some of these apps are doing. Why are they struggling? Why am I seeing a spinning wheel of death as it tries to get data? I don't get it.
Yeah, I'd be curious to find out this answer too, because the Series 3, it's super fast. It's way faster than I've ever seen the Apple Watch be. And for apps to just not work for 20-30 seconds, there's got to be something going on there.
Like I sat sometimes I'll sit there with the Facebook Messenger app open on my watch and I will literally be staring at it for like 60 seconds and it still hasn't loaded anything.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the hell's
going on. Like I'm just looking through apps right now, like Fantastical. Great.
Oh, that works reliably.
That loads instantly.
Every time.
Every single time. So they're doing a good job. Good job, Fantastical.
Maybe it's not as data intensive, though.
The Deliveries app, also great. It updates, takes a few seconds.
Instagram only recently started working. Instagram's been really buggy. Have you tried it? Like half the time it doesn't load notifications.
I have not.
It's really bad.
Apple Store app loads instantly.
Of course.
CalcBot loads in about 2 seconds, which is awesome.
Let's see if Instagram works today. I'm going to try it. Usually if I click on feed, it just says connection lost.
Foursquare loads instantly, which is surprising.
You know what? Instagram had a recent update, I think, in the last week. It started working. They must have fixed it.
Hmm.
Yeah, now I'm getting activity notifications and I can browse my Instagram feed on this beautiful tiny screen. I mean, it could be watchOS 4.2 is in beta now, so it could be a variety of API-related quirks.
It's
Who knows?
It's possible.
Who knows? All I know is Apple's own apps seem to work pretty consistently. I've never had an Apple app not load data on my watch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really bizarre, and it seems to happen more to some apps and less to other apps.
I'm actually thinking I should probably start uninstalling, instead of every single app that supports an Apple Watch app probably does not need to be on my watch.
Yeah. Right?
So like I should probably just put the apps that I only need on there. There's nothing else I could really say about this other than that the consistency hasn't been good, and I'm hoping that, again, it is early days for Apple Watch, but I just hope that the quality of apps start to improve quickly, especially now that native apps are going to be demanded.
Yeah. Honestly, I've kind of been of the opinion that Apple Watch apps are mostly unnecessary.
Why do you say that?
Well, because the watch is kind of suited for health tracking and notifications.
Yeah, but there are situations where having an app on a complication are really useful. Like for a third-party podcast app, like, I don't want to have to open my phone to load a podcast, right? So having that, and even having, like, Overcast has a complication. I'm not using Overcast right now just because I kind of, for some things, prefer Castro. But Castro has no Watch OS app at all. Overcast is the only one that I know of that has both a watch app and a complication. So you can have that shortcut and open the app and you can load a podcast on there, which is really nice, to have. I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, because if we were to not have those apps on there, that would remove a lot of functionality.
Well,
I mean, I've got Shazam screen here,
The thing is, complications, I think, should still be a thing. But I think for the most part, a lot of apps end up being superfluous. I think Apple, like, if they're not going to get rid of apps entirely, I think they really need to take another look and rethink how apps should work on this platform.
Sure.
Like, should they just be providing smart notifications about things?
Right.
Or like actionable, like kind of widget cards? Like, should they even be like disconnected experiences that you have to go into? or should the watch have something like watch faces you scroll through horizontally, maybe you scroll vertically through apps and you can just kind of swipe through this card stack of information.
And so Instagram too, do I really need the Instagram feed replicated on my watch?
Not really.
It's not the place to be looking at photos.
There's some things that shouldn't be on the watch.
Like what? What's a good example of something you think really doesn't need to be there?
Well, Instagram for one. Slack probably doesn't need a watch app. Like, all that does is it shows
you. You can barely call it a watch, though. You can barely call it a watch app, though, because it really, really doesn't.
It doesn't do anything. Like, it shows you the team that you were in last. It lets you look at your DMs and your mentions, and that's it. So, I mean, what's the point of that? You get notifications from Slack on your watch that you can reply to anyways.
Yeah, but if you don't have time to reply to it right there, then you'd want to have to go back later. And then you have to pull your iPhone out. I mean,
well, it would still be in your notifications unless you dismiss them.
Okay. That is true.
So
that is true.
You know, it.
See, but I also have a bad habit of dismissing things and then forgetting.
So, yeah, I mean, there's tons of stuff that doesn't need to be on the watch. And I think really the system just needs to be rethought in terms of like presenting intelligent information in a way that's easily digestible. So, I mean, having some kind of a card stack for apps would be great. Some kind of like mega complication view where every app is like a giant complication or like a watch face basically that gives you tidbits of information plus like two or three key actionable controls. So like for Tweetbot, maybe like it has a view of like the 10 most recent tweets or something, or like a mini timeline and then a button to tweet. And I don't know what else, but that's kind of the bare bones functionality it needs to have, really. Same for Facebook Messenger. All it has to do is let you see your conversations, and that's it. And I mean, to their credit, that is what the app does when it works. I think people try to do too much with watch apps, and they end up getting really busy and top heavy, and like half the stuff just doesn't need to be there. So I think Apple just needs to take another look.
Sounds like you're saying not necessarily that physical entity of the app needs to completely go away, but it sounds like you're saying rethink the way the app is made and what it's supposed to do.
Like my thought about it is that apps on the watch should feel more like iMessage apps.
Yes.
Where they kind of just live inside the overall architecture of the watch.
Yeah.
But they're still sort of separate.
Yeah.
But you can always access them no matter where you are, like that kind of notion. So, I mean, they already have the dock. I think the dock should really just be this new app card view where you're just swiping up through all the apps that you have or something. And then maybe they could intelligently sort them based on notifications like, oh, you got a Slack notification. So
push that
the
up
Slack
to the
app
top.
Is at the top of the stack.
Absolutely.
Things like that.
That makes sense. You know, I we're probably going to see this stuff sooner than later, right? Because we're already at 4.1.
I think we're due for a major rethink in watchOS 5, especially now that they have the horsepower.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the thing is,
we're really at a good moment in terms of, like you're saying, a really great moment in terms of the hardware. Because come WWDC 2018, which is not that long from now, they'll probably have a big update for it.
I think
with
so.
With some pretty substantial things.
And I think there will be watches that unfortunately are left behind. I think...
Well, Series 0, that's for
Series
sure.
0 will be left behind. Series 1 will probably be left behind. I think it'll be Series 2 and up that'll get watchOS 5. Just because if they do rethink it and add the kind of stuff I'm talking about, it'll need that horsepower.
But they still sell the Series 1, although it has a slightly updated CPU. So do you think
what
are they going to do about the entry-level model?
That's true. Never mind.
I mean, the original Series 0
Yeah.
Like that.
The very original
is
watch.
Not supported.
Yeah. The very original watch will go away.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the Series 1 has a version of the Series 2 CPU in it. It's just not quite as fast. And it doesn't have GPS. That's it. So yeah, it should be able to handle whatever changes. Like I think they'll basically treat Series 1 as the lowest common denominator. And whatever they're going to change, they're going to use that as the baseline. And I mean, Series 1 and 2, they're pretty fast. But Series 3 is just so much noticeably faster compared to that. I wouldn't say it's a big difference. It's just the kind of difference that you can notice and appreciate. Like, it's maybe the difference between 24 frames a second and 30 frames a second, you know?
Oh, like, right. Okay.
Like, Series 2 kind of seems fast, but not quite. Like, it seems slightly off. And then you get to the Series 3 and it's like, whoa, this is butter. I'm pretty confident that whatever they do, it'll be somewhat substantial, given that they're dropping the ultra slow Series 0. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And then, of course, we have Series 4 coming up next September, which I think will be the first redesign of the watch hardware.
Yeah, and also just as we sort of wrap for this week, you know, as December encroaches and we get close to the holiday times here, I know a lot of people have been very disappointed with iOS 11's reliability from in a variety of ways. And I think like any major new operating system, you get bugs, obviously.
Yeah.
And my recollection is that iOS 10 had similar issues and it took, I think, even up to 10.3 to get pretty stable.
Yeah.
So for those of you listening to this that are running iOS 11.1.2, which is the current stable release, and watchOS 4.1, which is the stable release for that, although watchOS is in, I think, a little bit better shape than iOS 11.
Mm-hmm.
Before Christmas time, we should have iOS 11.2,
yep.
Which is getting closer and closer to release, and watchOS 4.2, which is currently in beta. So I think a nice little present to us before the holidays will be some stability.
Yep. 11.2 is definitely very solid. It's been really good on my 10, although I would expect it to be because it's the 10.
And I actually did run the 11.2 public beta on my older iPhone 6S Plus, which I no longer have.
Yeah.
And actually, that improved the performance.
It did.
It ran, the animations were a little smoother.
Okay.
Noticeably smoother.
Okay, yeah.
11.1 was feeling a bit, a little rough around the edges.
So I think this is consistent with my I want to say theory, but it's not quite, because it is based on some knowledge I have, that a lot of iOS 11 was focused on getting the iPhone 10 to work properly, which, I mean, you can see, because there's just so much detail in all of the new interface elements in the iPhone 10, like everything from the new multitasking system to the animation that happens when you bring down the control center. Like, there's just so much effort that clearly went into it that bugs for other iPhones probably got deprioritized.
Yeah.
So now they're basically going back and fixing up all of these issues.
I can guarantee you, though, come September next year when we have iOS 12, this is a new thing for me. I am no longer updating either macOS or iOS to the latest version. I'm going to stay a year behind, and I'm going to stick with that.
Oof.
Especially with iOS. I honestly, maybe not a year for iOS, but I mean, for macOS, I have to because of pro audio stuff, and it doesn't matter as much. But with iOS, I think this will be more realistic. I won't upgrade until at least 0.2.
Yeah.
Like this year, I really should have not upgraded until 11.2 came out. I should have waited.
Yeah, I would also throw in the caveat that if you do get a new iPhone, I mean, obviously it's going to be the latest version anyways, but it'll probably have less issues on the new software if you get a new iPhone. I think if you can afford to wait, if there's no like super critical feature that you're like, oh my God, I have to have this, then yeah, I think definitely wait till 0.1 or 0.2, because then it starts to gain some degree of stability after whatever churn happened between WWDC and September. Because yeah, like oftentimes a lot of the resources go into supporting the new iPhone and whatever features it has. And then bugs on older iPhones kind of get left behind. I mean, that happens in software development all the time. Like if your milestone is to ship the new iPhone with whatever software features, you've got to focus on that. And if iOS breaks on an iPhone 6S or an iPhone 5 or whatever, like that has to get pushed down in the backlog because you're busy trying to land all of these features for the new iPhone so that when the new iPhone comes out, nobody's disappointed by their new shiny toy, right? So
yeah, I understand this stuff because I've been in software development.
Yeah, so. Like it's just a reality of
yeah.
the business. Like you can't right. fix all bugs.
But the average consumer, of course, doesn't really understand that or know that. Right.
Yeah, for the most part.
Right. Someone with a 2-year-old phone, they think they're getting the shaft. And I understand why.
Yeah, it's easy to think that. But yeah, like...
But like you're saying, eventually this stuff does get ironed out after a few versions.
It does. And of course, towards the other half of the support spectrum, like phones that are basically on life support, they're going to be obsoleted within a year. Like the iPhone 6, for example. That's now 3 phones removed. So
my dad still has an iPhone 6 Plus, and I got to tell you, it's feeling slow.
Yeah,
it's feeling really slow.
So I mean, once you get to that point, Apple is definitely not focusing on that hardware anymore. Yeah.
See, that's the thing too, because if you have one of those older devices, if you stick with an older version of iOS, it still feels pretty new.
Yeah.
Like iOS 10.3.3 was perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Perfectly fine on an iPhone 6.
Yeah.
iOS 11? No.
Yeah.
Just no.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of that is because they start incorporating new technologies and start taking advantage of the better hardware.
Animations change that maybe put a little more tax on, they're a little more taxing on the GPU.
Yeah, well, like I mean, because iOS 11 moved to Metal 2, which is now way more performant and way more dependent on the GPU. So if the GPU in the iPhone 6 isn't as good as the 6S, 7, and 8,
you're gonna
and
have
10,
a problem. Yeah.
Then yeah, it's going to cause problems.
Yeah.
So some of this stuff, they just can't really fix because they're moving forward. Yeah. And if the hardware doesn't support whatever they're trying to do, they just have to move on,
yeah.
really. Unfortunately, I mean, they can't support hardware forever. They do their best, but when they make these big changes, stuff inevitably starts to get left behind for the good of the majority of products. I think their focus is essentially the current iPhone and then 2 iPhones older than that. But then when iOS 13 rolls around, the 6S will basically be gone because most people will have upgraded.
Yeah, because their contracts are done or they renewed them and they got a new phone.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just normal. That's
yeah.
normal.
And it all fuels into that cadence, right? So, I mean, you have the contracts renewing, you get your new phone. And so Apple is able to make these big changes because they know that people replace their phones every 2 to 3 years. That's basically why their support window is the current phone plus 2 old ones, because it's in that 3-year window, right? So then as phones start to move out of that window, less support until finally it's unusable or it just doesn't get new iOS updates.
So next week, Tuesday, I believe November the 28th,
mm-hmm.
Today's episode that we're recording is going to be come out. So this episode will be post Black Friday.
Yes.
So I just wanted to kind of end on a note of be safe out there if you shop at retail stores. We want to make sure that you come back.
The real deal seekers buy stuff on Cyber that Monday, Alex.
True. That is very true. And don't leave their house.
Yep.
Buy online.
Yep. Get those Amazon deals. Yeah.
Maybe next week, if you get anything cool, let us know. We might have to talk about that.
I doubt it, but we'll see.
I don't think anyone is interested in our rampant consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to the Impromptu One Hologram Radio. I'm Alex Knight, joined by Michael Norton, as always. If you'd like to show your support for this podcast and the work that we do here, the single best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/hologramradio and donate today. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes to ensure you get every new episode each and every week. And do leave us a review if you have a moment. That makes us feel good, as well as helps other people find the podcast. We're also available in Google Play Music, TuneIn, and Stitcher as well if you'd like to stream it there, and wherever else you can find podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. Michael Norton is at Zen Impulse. I'm at Zero Distraction. And if you'd like to send us feedback the old-fashioned way, you can email us at theimpromptu@hologramradio.org, and that will go to both myself and Michael.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.